Let us be clear about one thing. The ministry of Isaiah the prophet was no great pleasure, neither to him nor to the people. His words were full of judgment and anger, in turn for which he was discounted, mocked, and set upon. And in circumstances like these, your sense of calling is all the more important. Otherwise, how could you carry on? We have in Isaiah 6 one of, or even the best known vocation narrative in the Hebrew Scriptures. And it's no accident that Isaiah wrote it all down. It functioned, if you will, as his credentials, his license to say the kinds of things that he said. I'm speaking to you in the name of God, so get off my case. That's how that works, right? Now, much to our benefit, the church is beginning to claim this language of vocation or calling for all the baptized. It's not just priests who get the call, whatever that means. My sense is that all kinds of people, and at all times in our lives, are trying to discern what is their God-given ministry or purpose in the world. And to the extent that that is true for any, each, all of us, we may profitably study Isaiah's experience, which in my experience, at least, was in many ways pretty much how it goes, normative. So did you notice, first of all, that Isaiah's call comes to him in the context of worship? He is in the temple. It's at the time of the sacrificial offering. There are hot coals on the altar and there's smoke everywhere. Now, I'm not saying that God will only speak to us in prayer, but prayer does affect the one needful thing for someone who is trying to discern God's will, and that is to make us accessible to God. Anyone who has ever found church the place where unexpected, perhaps even unwanted, tears announce themselves will know what this means. There's something about prayer that makes us real, that pulls down the barriers and allows some kind of genuine commerce between our souls and the heart and the mind of God. But do you notice next how explainable Isaiah's vision was? There was nothing about that prayer that could not have been attributed, and probably was by his detractors, to an overactive imagination. In all likelihood, he was attending the annual enthronement festival. So no wonder he saw the Lord sitting high and lifted up. And the seraphim? Oh, you know, look around. Probably like the faces of kings liberated from their carvings and accorded a reality larger than life. And the antiphonal chorus of holy, 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 the anthem of the day, sung by humans, not angels. Similarly, the smoke. Of course he saw smoke. There was a fire on the altar. So you could see that in the cooler, headier light of reason, it would have been so easy to dismiss Isaiah's vision as a sort of religious version of the Nutcracker ballet where all the toys in the room come to life. And in its way, this is our experience too. The very insight, the very coincidence which all but impels us to a certain action sounds just, I don't know, a little silly when you try and explain it to somebody else. Be sure to take the point, though. This is what genuine vocation is like. Next, Isaiah tells us that the pivots on the threshold shook and the house filled with smoke. Can you try and imagine what that would have been like? The very foundations are shaking, and it is dark. The ground is shifting beneath your feet, and you can't see your way to safety. One of the key insights of the Christian mystics is that God is most profoundly to be discovered in what is called the dark night of the soul, or sometimes the cloud of unknowing. That is, in those times when we are the least sure of God's presence or purpose for us. You know, if you read the book of Exodus, you'll discover that the better Moses knows God, the longer their relationship goes on, the darker the encounters become. Remember how Moses first meets God? It's in a burning bush, bright fire, attractive. But by the end, God is coming to him in a cloud. All of which is to say that God is most specially hidden in our confusions and uncertainty about what to do next. Part of discerning our vocation is having the courage to stick with the not knowing. Well, Isaiah recognizes that even in all that dark, he has, in some sense, as he says, seen God, and he's not happy about it. "Woe is me," he cries. "I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell amongst a people of unclean lips." That's a really interesting confession, because don't forget that if Isaiah has been admitted into the temple precincts, and clearly he has, if he's seeing all these things, he has at the very least rendered himself ritually clean to gain admittance. And yet, in spite of this, he feels unclean. Who knows, maybe he's an especially humble creature, or maybe he really is more sinful than the rest of us. We can't know. He might be, that might be the case. But this said, Isaiah is not alone in this reaction to a sense of call. Again and again, the Bible introduces us to characters who were reluctant to play their part and painfully aware of their weaknesses. Moses dithered because he lacked eloquence. God finally gets up and says, "Oh, for heaven's sakes, take your brother Aaron. He talks a mile a minute." Jeremiah, because he lacked age. And God says, "Oh, stop it. Don't talk about being a child." Paul, because he persecuted the church. And so on. One might even conclude that resistance, a profound sense of one's unworthiness to serve, in fact, the desire not to serve anything but this, is actually a sign of the genuineness of one's call. What is most striking to me about Isaiah's sense of unworthiness is where he locates it. This is a man called to the ministry of a prophet, a man whose lips are his stock in trade. So notice then that it is precisely his mouth which Isaiah designates as unclean. It's not that he doesn't think he's bright enough or dedicated enough or politically incisive enough, but that he has so often harnessed the key instrument of his ministry, his tongue, to other less worthy purposes. And we're left to guess. Lies, gossip, idle chatter, gluttony, complaint. It's my observation that very often when God calls, what we are being asked to do is to refocus our failings in such a way that they become strengths. Now, that does not come about by dint of human effort alone. Isaiah couldn't just say, well, okay, from now on I'll only ever say positive, holy things. I've tried that, it doesn't work. Our ability to answer God's call is assisted by God's own healing grace. And I know that such cleansing, while tenderly administered, is not always painless. I cannot think that a hot coal touched to Isaiah's lips would not have burnt. God will thus prepare us to undertake our vocation and ministry, not merely by fortifying our strengths, but as anyone who has seriously undertaken the spiritual journey knows, also by purging our weaknesses. And so it is that we come to the last vignette of Isaiah's vision. He hears God addressing the heavenly host. Whom will we send? Who will go for us? And the humble prophet, his eyes still dimmed by the darkness, his footing still unsure, his lips still seared, steps forward and says, I'm here, send me. Amen.